Chapter 2. Solving the Dilemma.
If God is dead, then the universe must have birthed humanity through the emotionless parents of time and chance. From this perspective, humans are not a unique creation, reflecting the personal attributes of a loving father. We are merely the accidental and unwanted pregnancy of energy acting on matter. The universe coughed up some phlegm that is personal and self-aware, only to swallow it right back down again. Under this view, humans might feel moral urges, but we live in an amoral universe. We might sense that our choices are within our control, but this is impossible in light of our causally determined universe. We might hope that our lives are significant, but this is unattainable in a universe that is ultimately doomed to death. Just imagine what a consistent atheistic worldview would do to our everyday lives. How could someone celebrate a 30th wedding anniversary or kiss a newborn baby on the forehead when they know that these feelings are just the result of their hormones and inherited primal instincts? How could somebody say goodbye to an elderly parent on their deathbed when they know that these urges of love are simply programmed into our genetic makeup? If you know and keep on remembering that these feelings are merely chemical reactions evolved to proliferate your DNA and your offspring, how would this affect your ability to love others with any level of authenticity? If you were consistent with this worldview, it would lead to discontentment. However, if you found yourself content in life, it would only be because you were acting inconsistently. The result would be a great and terrible tension to life, a desperate dilemma. The terrible tension of the desperate dilemma. Consider Jay Budiszewski, a former atheistic ethics professor who had tried to live consistently with his naturalistic worldview. After he came to faith in Christ later in life, he wrote this: "I loved my wife and children, somehow I still did, but I was determined to regard this love as merely a subjective preference with no real and objective value, and that I was involved in this love for reasons that were out of my control, traceable back to causes antecedent to me. Think what that did to the very capacity to love them. After all, what is love? It is not a feeling. Love is a commitment of the will to the true good of another person. And how can your will be committed to the true good of another person if you deny the reality of good, deny the reality of persons, and deny that your commitments are in your control?" As skeptic David Hume reflected on his atheism, he felt that it placed a dismal chill on the events of his life. He writes, "I dine, I play a game of backgammon, I converse, and I am merry with my friends. And when after 3 or 4 hours' amusement I would return to these speculations, they appear so cold and strained and ridiculous that I cannot find it in my heart to enter into them any farther." Agnostic Bertrand Russell writes, "It is odd, isn't it? I care passionately for this world and many things and people in it. And yet, what is it all? There must be something more important, one feels, though I don't believe that there is." Atheist Susan Blackmore writes, "We can reject any persisting entity that corresponds to our feeling of being a self. The trouble is that it is very hard to accept in one's own personal life. It means taking a radically different view of every experience. It means accepting that there is no one who is having these experiences. It means accepting that every time I seem to exist, this is just a temporary fiction, and not the same me who existed a moment before, or last week, or last year. This is tough, but I think it gets easier with practice." Easier with practice? Is she kidding? This is horrifying to consider. Every time you feel like you're making decisions, you have to deny that feeling and remember that you are not. Every time you feel like your actions are within your control, you have to remind yourself that they aren't. But if we can't believe that our thoughts are in our own control, then all bets are off. If we cannot believe something so basic, then how could we believe anything at all? Blackmore concludes her chapter on free will by writing, "If you do agree and you conclude that free will is an illusion, how can you and should you live your life? Some people conclude that there is no point in doing anything, and they might as well give up. But this does not follow from the argument, nor is it easy to carry out. If you think you may as well give up, then ask yourself just what you will do, for you will have to face the fact that you cannot simply do nothing. Staying in bed all day is not doing nothing, and you are bound to get up for food or the toilet. Ending your life is not doing nothing, and it is neither easy nor enjoyable. By facing up to how life might be without a belief in free will, it is easier to let go of the illusion. Then what? Even if free will is technically an illusion, it is a very powerful illusion, and so the feeling of being free carries on, even for people who no longer believe it's true. Such people sometimes say that they live as if free will existed, and as if they and others had selves. That way they can live honestly, without believing in something they know cannot possibly be true. For others, the feeling finally disappears. Blackmore's solution to the desperate dilemma is to live as if free will existed, even though she knows it doesn't. In other words, her solution is to live inconsistently with her own belief system. It goes without saying that it's impossible to be content in an atheistic worldview. Otherwise, she would not need to live as if her worldview was false. Agnostic neuroscientist Michael Gazzaniga observes, "The simple truth is that even the most strident determinists and fatalists at the personal psychological level do not actually believe that they are pawns in the brain's chess game." How could they? Professor James Sire writes, "Socrates said that the unexamined life is not worth living, but for a naturalist, he is wrong. For a naturalist, it is the examined life that is not worth living." The more we dwell on the atheistic worldview, the less we wish that we had done so. This tension is so thick that it leads some to consider suicide. If there is no purpose to life, then why bother living? If we are truly just programmed biological machines, why does anything ultimately matter? Atheistic philosopher Albert Camus explains, "There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. In a universe absent of God, our personal characteristics do not raise us up as unique and superior beings. Rather, they serve as weights that drag us down and drown us. Our personality drowns us because we are surrounded by the all-encompassing universe, which is deaf, dull, and devoid of our personal attributes. If God does not exist, then it would have been better if evolution hadn't taken this wicked turn, producing a species of persons rather than a species of primates." Perhaps no one has better explained the desperate dilemma than Pulitzer Prize winner Annie Dillard in her book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Dillard went away from civilization to observe the natural order. After a while, she realized how horrific nature really is, filled as it is with death and decay. Her description of the desperate dilemma is as horrifying as it is beautifully written. She writes, "This direction of thought brings me abruptly to a fork in the road where I stand paralyzed, unwilling to go on, for both ways lead to madness. Either this world is a monster, or I myself am a freak. Consider the former, the world is a monster. Any three-year-old can see how unsatisfactory and clumsy is this whole business of reproducing and dying by the billions. But wait, you say, there is no right and wrong in nature. Right and wrong is a human concept." Precisely. We are moral creatures, then, in an amoral world. The universe that suckled us is a monster that does not care if we live or die, does not care if it itself grinds to a halt. It is fixed and blind, a robot programmed to kill. We are free and seeing. We can only try to outwit it at every turn to save our skins. This view requires that a monstrous world, running on chance and death, careening blindly from nowhere to nowhere, somehow produced wonderful us. I came from the world. I crawled out of a sea of amino acids, and now I must whirl around and shake my fist at that sea and cry, shame. We little blobs of soft tissue crawling around on this planet's skin are right, and the whole universe is wrong. Or consider the alternative. I must consider the second fork in the road. The creation itself is blamelessly, benevolently askew by its very free nature, and that it is only human feeling that is freakishly amiss. Does the lacewing who eats her eggs care? If they do not care, then why am I making all this fuss? If I am a freak, then why don't I just hush? All right then, it is our emotions that are amiss. We are freaks and the world is fine, and let us all go have lobotomies to restore us to a natural state. We can leave the library then, go back to the creek lobotomized, and live on its banks as untroubled as any muskrat or reed. You first. Either the human race is abnormal, or the naturalistic worldview is. Dillard suggests that a lobotomy would solve this dilemma, but she humorously adds, "You first." While a lobotomy would solve our dilemma, few would choose it. projecting a meaning. To avoid the horror and despair of an atheistic universe, many project a meaning onto the universe and their lives. For instance, at the close of his book, Atheism and Philosophy, philosopher Kai Nielsen writes, that there is no purpose to life does not imply that there is no purpose in life. There is nothing man was made for, but he can and does have purposes in the sense that he has aims, goals, and things he finds worth seeking and admiring. These can and typically do give significance and moral ambience to our lives. While Nielsen's suggestion might put our minds at ease to some extent, projecting a meaning to life doesn't solve the desperate dilemma. For example, consider the placebo effect. Doctors will sometimes prescribe sugar pills or placebos to patients, telling them that the pills are an experimental medicine. When people think that they're taking a medicine, minor ailments are often cured. However, there is just one problem. A placebo cannot work if we know it's a placebo. The more you know you're taking a placebo, the less it's able to help you. In the same way, the more we know that our projected meaning to the universe is really just an illusion, the less it's able to bring fulfillment. In addition, projecting a meaning is absurd when meanings conflict. For instance, someone might claim he's found his purpose to life in saving the rainforests, while someone else may say her purpose to life is making copious amounts of money by cutting down the rainforests. If two people say that they have both found a purpose to life, but they are contradicting each other, how can these both be true? Isn't it obvious? They aren't true. They are merely imagining a purpose for their lives within a universe that is numb to their desires and ambitions. Imagine if believers in God said that they found a meaning to life by projecting God onto the universe. Atheists would scoff, "You can't invent God to give your life meaning. Either he exists or he doesn't." Yet this is exactly what many atheists do regarding their meaning to life. Projecting a meaning doesn't give us a meaning. Art project gone wrong. Having a subjective meaning to life is useless if there is no objective meaning behind it. For example, consider a prolific modern artist living in New York City. The artist hosts an art show in his penthouse suite, and as a practical joke, he has his 3-year-old nephew splatter paint across a canvas for a couple of hours. He takes the canvas and hangs it in the center of his show. That night, dozens of art critics pour into his flat to survey his most recent work. After a long night of gourmet cheese and French wine, the artist explains to everyone that he will be revealing a piece that has taken him over a decade to complete. He calls it his greatest work. Everyone in the soiree gathers in anticipation to view his masterpiece. A hush sweeps over the crowd as they stand in front of the piece of art, which is robed in a giant velvet cloth. In a loud, confident voice, the artist declares, "Ladies and gentlemen, I give you my most prized work. I call it The Meaning of Life." Immediately after he announces the title, he pulls the cloth away from the canvas, revealing his nephew's chaotic splattering of paints. The art critics quickly analyze the painting, attempting to discern its meaning, developing theory after theory. Some think it represents the plight of women in the workplace. Others believe it has religious symbolism. Others think it reflects the issues he had with his mother as a child. Their speculation goes on for hours, until finally the artist can't stand it any longer. After polishing off his second bottle of wine, he erupts with laughter, screaming, "You fools! This thing isn't a valuable piece of art. It's a steaming pile of crap. This masterpiece is actually the result of a 3-year-old throwing globs of paint at a canvas for a couple of hours. The whole thing is meaningless. It's all a big joke." The artist's meaning to the painting doesn't go over well. Most of the critics feel embarrassed as he laughs at their desire to find a meaning in the assorted splotches of paint on the canvas. They leave the party feeling betrayed and outraged, slamming the doors behind them. Others do not leave. Instead, they continue to muse at the painting on the wall, developing more theories about its meaning. The artist mocks them. "What are you doing? I just told you that this is a bunch of random globs of paint. There's no purpose behind it. It arose from the chance tosses of my nephew." The art critics ignore him and continue to form theories about the piece's meaning, undeterred by his mocking. They insist that they can find a purpose in the painting, even though he explicitly tells them that it is purposeless, the blind product of chance and necessity. In a similar way, while we can each invent a meaning to life, this doesn't mean that any meaning actually exists. In an atheistic universe, we are not discovering a purpose. Rather, We're imagining one. In the absence of a creator, we are simply projecting a purpose onto a universe that is deaf, dumb, and blind to our musings. It means absolutely nothing to say that I have found a purpose in the universe, if the universe itself is without purpose. What's the best explanation? Ask yourself, is it more plausible to believe that purpose came from futility, meaning came from meaninglessness, freedom came from determinism, love came from indifference, morality came from an amoral universe? These basic human experiences are best explained by a personal and ultimate being. In her 2012 CNN interview, famed atheistic blogger Leah Libresco explained her conversion to Christianity in this way. It was almost the same thing as any scientific theory. Christianity had more explanatory power to explain something that I was really sure of. I'm really sure morality is objective and independent. It is something we uncover, like archaeologists, not something we build, like architects. And I was having trouble explaining morality in my own philosophy. And Christianity offered an explanation, which I came to find compelling. Libresco is right. Of the four major worldviews, theism provides the best explanation for morality and meaning. Pantheism is an ultimate foundation, but it isn't a personal one. Polytheism is a personal foundation, but it isn't ultimate. Atheism, of course, is neither personal nor ultimate. However, theism is both personal and ultimate. It serves as the best foundation for these human longings, which we can perceive quite clearly. A walking contradiction. While some atheists attempt to live consistently with their worldview, this is easier said than done. For instance, atheist Susan Blackmore admits that free will is a grand illusion, but then she writes a book trying to change the minds of people who supposedly don't have free will. Atheist Richard Dawkins admits that our universe has, quote, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. However, he continues to write hundreds of pages in his books, excoriating the evils of religion. This sort of inconsistency could make your head spin. We shouldn't just believe in God because it makes us feel better. Instead, we should believe in him because it would be impossible to deny these first principles and assumptions of human existence without living every day as a walking contradiction. Most atheists that I know are living as though morality is objective and real, and they treat other people as though they were free moral agents, not determined or programmed biological machines. However, based on their atheistic worldview, they have no reason to do this. They are living on borrowed capital from a Christian worldview, while at the same time denying the Christian God. When you think about it, this isn't just inconsistent, it's hypocritical. It's hypocritical to live as though there is a God, while at the same time denying that he exists.